انی اخاف، من میترسم. ایمسک عوام من الرحمن.
In Surah Maryam, Ayah 45, we read, I am indeed afraid that a punishment from the All-Beneficent will befall you. In this ayah, you can see that Allah is called the All-Beneficent. We must understand that Allah is forgiving, and even when He wants to warn the people about punishment, He talks with kindness and mercy. Also in Ayah 98 of Surah Al-Ma'idah, we read, Know that Allah is severe in retribution, and that Allah is all-forgiving, all-merciful.
اگه شدت عقاب رو تو آیه آورده، تو همون آیه غفور بودن و رحیم بودن آورده.
It is true that Allah is severe in punishment for the evildoers. However, He is full of mercy and forgiveness. The harshness of Allah is because He wants His people to repent. Allah is willing to give His creatures a second chance for repentance because He is merciful. In other words, Allah's warning is different from people. Our warning make the people away from Allah, but Allah's warning is a way back to repentance and the mercy of Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech. This was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Muradi. To find out more about this program and other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Christians and Christianity are under attack in Gaza and Palestine more generally. Zionist ideology is not just anti-Muslim, it is anti-Christian too. What is the common factor that links Muslims and Christians in Palestine? They're Palestinian. So it's no surprise that the Zionists are making sure to destroy churches as well as mosques. On October the 19th, Israel bombed the Church of St. Porphyrius, Gaza's oldest, killing at least 18 people. The church is said to be the third oldest Christian church in the world, with the current building having been constructed by the Crusaders in the 1150s or 1160s. A church was built on the site as early as 425 AD. 2 days earlier, an explosion at Al Ahli Arab Hospital, an Anglican institution located a few blocks away, killed and injured hundreds, according to Palestinian health authorities. The evidence is beginning to mount that the attacks on specifically Christian targets are themselves a specific genocide contained within the larger genocide aimed at Muslims and indeed all Palestinians. On December 16th, the Zionists directly targeted a Christian convent. An Israeli army sniper assassinated two Christian women, Nahed and her daughter Samar, inside the parish of the Holy Family in Gaza on Saturday, said the Latin Patriarchate's media office. One of the women fell while trying to rescue the other. Seven others were injured while attempting to help. Gunfire was directed at them inside the walls of the monastery, and there was no resistance in the area, it added. An Israeli artillery vehicle also targeted the Monastery of the Sisters of Mother Teresa in Gaza City, which shelters more than 54 disabled individuals within the church walls. The Zionist attack also destroyed the fuel tank, the power generator, and the solar panels, in addition to extensive damage that rendered the place unsuitable for habitation or providing care for people with disabilities. On January the 26th this year, a mob of Israeli settlers attacked an Armenian bar in the Christian quarter of the Old City of Jerusalem, shouting, "Death to Arabs, death to Christians." At the beginning of October, a video emerged of ultra-Orthodox settlers in Al-Quds spitting on Christian pilgrims. Armed and violent settlers are also in the process of attempting to liquidate the Armenian quarter in Al-Quds, and with it, the wider Christian presence, which has been there continuously since the 4th century. Only 800 to 1,000 Christians are believed to still live in Gaza, constituting the oldest Christian community in the world, dating back to the 1st century.
This year, Christmas celebrations are cancelled in Bethlehem, and for obvious reasons. It's impossible to celebrate while our people in Gaza are going through a genocide.
It's no wonder the church in Palestine has cancelled Christmas.
Hunger has become the most pressing of the myriad problems facing hundreds of thousands of displaced Gaza Palestinians, with aid trucks able to bring in only a small fraction of what is needed, and distribution uneven due to the chaos of the war. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, a Geneva-based rights group, has found that 71% of people in the Gaza Strip suffer from extreme hunger due to Israel's devastating war on the Palestinian territory and the regime's method of using starvation as a weapon. The group released the figure after it conducted an analytical study of a sample of 1,200 people in Gaza. According to the study's findings, 98% of respondents said that they eat insufficient amounts of food, while 64% of the participants admitted to eating grass, immature food, and expired materials to satiate their hunger.
All 2.2 million people are hungry, meaning that they are in crisis or worse food security situation.
More than 130,000 of Gaza's most vulnerable children, that is newborns up to 2 years of age, are not receiving the critical life-saving breastfeeding or age-appropriate complementary feeding that they absolutely require. So that's our scenario. Without sufficient safe water, food and sanitation that only a humanitarian ceasefire would bring, child deaths due to disease could well surpass those already killed in bombardments.
The study found that the rate of access to water in the Gaza Strip, including drinking, bathing and cleaning water, is 1.5 liters per person per day. This is 15 liters less than the minimum amount of water required for survival at the level required by international standards. Additionally, the study examined the effects of malnutrition and a lack of access to clean drinking water. 66% of the study sample reported having experienced diarrhea, skin rashes, or intestinal diseases in the past month. Even in Rafah, which has a crossing to Egypt through which aid trucks enter, the dearth of food and clean water is so severe it is causing people to get ill.
The contaminated water is another issue, as the water is not 100% clean, so children and adults suffer from intestinal problems such as vomiting and diarrhea. So I ran out of antidiarrheal medications, Flagyl medicines, which is an intestinal disinfectant, and Silabrin, which is antibiotics for intestinal infections. There's a significant loss of these drugs.
Since the start of its genocide in Gaza, Israel has imposed a comprehensive blockade on the Strip and prevented supplies of food, water, fuel, and other humanitarian necessities from reaching the more than 2.3 million residents of the Strip. Israel's use of starvation as a weapon has intensified since October 7 and has included cutting off all food supplies to Gazans, as well as bombing and destroying the Strip's bakeries, factories, food stores.
We were compelled to come here as there are no bakeries available. The people here who are our friends are baking bread to aid the community. Procuring flour is challenging for us, as a 20-kilogram bag costs around 300 to 400 shekels, which is a substantial amount.
About 577,000, meaning more than 500,000 people, are already in catastrophic levels of hunger, meaning they're essentially starving. That is like one in every four people.
Speeches and statements from Israeli officials promoting a campaign to deliberately block access to necessary resources for the Gaza population as a strategy indicate that Israel has not made these intentions a secret. The Israeli blockade, on top of the genocidal aggression, has plunged Gaza into humanitarian catastrophe, where lack of access to sanitation and safe water has increased the prevalence of waterborne diseases. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court says that intentionally starving civilians by, quote, depriving them of objects indispensable to their survival, including willfully impeding relief supplies, is a war crime.
The people in the hospitals, yes, they need everything. They need medical supplies, but what they ask for first is food and water, the very basics. They do not have them. One of my colleagues described people lying on the floor in severe pain, in agony, but they weren't asking for pain relief, they were asking for water.
The plight of Gaza's 2.3 million people has become desperate amid the war. Around 80% of Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip have been displaced by the violence, while efforts to get aid into the territory have struggled. Alarmed humanitarian organizations have been calling for a ceasefire and denouncing the shocking cost of the catastrophic war, which amounts to a collective punishment of the civilian population of Gaza.
We are homeless. We can't go back to our houses. I want to see my children. I want to go back to my husband and to my house. It's unfair. It's so unfair.
This is a firm response to Israel's genocide and aggression against Palestinians. It has been about 2.5 months since Israel launched its deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Muslim countries missed no chance to deplore the Israeli crimes verbally, but there were few, including Yemen, that firmly stood in solidarity with defenseless Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. After carrying out drone and missile strikes on Israeli targets, Yemen's armed forces have now been targeting Israel-bound vessels in waters around their country. The army has time and again stated it would stop its operations if Israel stops its aggression and ends its blockade on Gaza. The Yemeni armed forces have also refuted claims about targeting ships moving toward other destinations. All vessels except Israel-bound ones can safely sail through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. As usual, Israel's main backer, the U.S., has been trying to reverse the impact of the Yemeni operations by announcing the formation of a maritime coalition under the pretext that it would protect the transit in the Red Sea. But Washington's main goal is to protect Israel's interest. However, Yemen's Ansarullah has issued strong warning to the U.S. Mohammed al-Bukhaiti, a senior Ansarullah official, says the newly formed coalition will get a painful response if it violates the sovereignty of the Arab country. But how significant the Yemeni operations in the Red Sea are? In recent weeks, Yemeni naval forces have targeted several vessels sailing through the Red Sea toward Israel. Their primary goal has been to exert economic pressure on Tel Aviv, and they have been rather successful. Several major companies have suspended their shipments to and from Israel in the wake of Yemen's operations in the Red Sea. This has dealt a heavy blow to Israel's economy, with the latest reports indicating that the port of Eilat is hardly hit as the result of this disruption.
The non-arrival of ships to Eilat means that there is no income for the port, while the fixed expenses for its maintenance and operation remain the same, and we have a substantial negative flow.
The almost complete halt to the arrival of ships to Eilat has led to an 80% fall in the port's profits. This is while reports say that Egypt's Suez Canal has seen no harm to its maritime activities during Yemen's operations against Israel-bound ships. The Red Sea is a strategic trade route connecting Asia to Europe through the Suez Canal. About 12% of global trade passes through the Red Sea, including 30% of global container traffic. The disruptions in this area have had a direct impact on global economy. Now, cargo ships traveling from Asia to Europe have to sail around the African continent. This has increased the transit time and led to higher freight rates and delays. Also, shipping insurance costs have jumped by tens of thousands of dollars a day, and oil prices have gone up as well. To sum up, the international community has been unable to stop the Israeli crimes against Palestinians through political means. However, it seems Yemenis have employed a successful tactic to pressurize Israel.
UN agencies continue to sound the alarm bell over the desperate humanitarian situation in the besieged coastal territory. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned that the people of Gaza are running out of time and options. Philippe Lazzaroni warned that Gaza is very far from an adequate humanitarian response.
The people of Gaza are running out of time and options as they face bombardment, deprivation, and disease in an ever shrinking space.
He described the situation in Gaza as hell on earth and said people in the Palestinian territory are facing the darkest chapter of its history since 1948. He described seeing people halting in aid truck and in desperation and swallowing down the food found inside where they stood in the street. Further noted that the people of Gaza are now crammed into less than one-third of their original territory near the Egyptian border, and the dire situation might spark an exodus. The city of Rafah on the Egyptian border, the only crossing where aid is entering Gaza, has seen its population explode from 280,000 to more than a million.
Rafah is the epicenter of the displacement of the Gazan. There is over 1 million people who have fled in this governorate, most of them, as we know, have been moved more than once since the beginning of the war. Rafah has quadrupled its number of people overnight, and especially when the offensive in the south has started.
UN officials have warned that any such exodus would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and it would make a problematic Palestinian problem more difficult. It is now widely believed that the Israeli regime is deliberately targeting residential areas and the critical infrastructure in Gaza in order to make the territory unlivable for its residents. Israel has already pushed the U.S. and its other Western allies to persuade Egypt to accept Palestinian people in the Sinai Peninsula.
It seems very difficult to us that if there was a population movement outside Gaza, I think that can only mean Egypt. It would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and that would make a solution to the Palestinian problem even more difficult.
The healthcare system is collapsing. Expect public order to completely break down soon. And an even worse situation could unfold, including epidemic diseases and increased pressure for mass displacement into Egypt. I said that we are facing a severe risk of collapse of the humanitarian system.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program. We are with Sheikh Javid, as always, who sheds some lights on some of the jurisprudential laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But this time, as we have started a series of episodes on Khums. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Let me start this episode with this question, Sheikh. In order to evade a payment of khums on their assets, a family, a husband and a wife, sometimes decide to give each other their annual income as gifts prior to the end of their khums year. Would you please explain to our audience the rule concerning their liability to khums?
Well, it is very much clear from the example you mentioned that the husband and wife are trying to evade payment. payment of homes, as you also mentioned it. And of course, in this very scenario, these two people are not exempted from the obligatory homes because they are giving each other's income as gifts to each other. Now, that's not okay. That's a very, very, that can be very, that's very much readable and very much understandable from the fact that they are trying to avoid paying homes and they are trying to evade paying homes. They are not serious about gifting money to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in this very scenario, homes should be paid by both parties, by both individuals, the husband and the wife.
I see.
Yes.
Okay. Well, a person deposited an amount of money with a Hajj travel agency in order to perform Mustahab Hajj, recommended Hajj. But unfortunately, he dies before he could visit the house of God. Shashawit, what's the ruling concerning this money? Is this money subject to homes, first of all? And then, is it obligatory for the heir to spend this money for the performance of Hajj on his behalf or her behalf?
Well, the value of the Hajj travel document obtained in exchange for the money deposited in the account of the Hajj agency is considered a part of his inheritance. And of course, we do know the rules regarding inheritance because inheritance is something to be received by the heirs. And inheritance is not liable for homes. There's no homes paid on inheritance, no matter what the amount and no matter what it is. It could be in the form of cash. It could be in the form of, let's say, a house or something left by the deceased person. Now, generally speaking, khums is not paid on inheritance. So it's not obligatory to spend it on performing Hajj on his behalf. Of course, if Hajj was not obligatory on him, and or when he had not made a will in this regard. And of course, when it comes to khums, if its khums has not been paid, paying its khums is obligatory in the given case because if that money was deposited and khums was not paid, according to His Eminence, the money which was stored, which was saved for paying khums since a year probably might have passed on it.
Mm-hmm.
According to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may he live long, paying the khums of that amount is obligatory in the very given scenario that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it is there, I should reiterate or repeat myself that if it is there as an inheritance, khums is not paid on inheritance, and that inheritance should be divided by among the heirs.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Shashawit. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah. Let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest, the speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to homes based on fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Well, Sheikh Javid, an orchard or a garden was transferred to an individual's children, like a son, as a gift or by way of inheritance, right?
Yes.
At that time, it was not of much value. It wasn't very much like pricey then. Mm. But its present market value is much greater than its previous one. Is there excess amount now subject to homes?
According to Ayatollah Khamenei, inheritance and gifts are not subject to khums, and nor the money earned from their sale, from the proceeds, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So khums is not paid on it either. Even if the value, the market value increases, now maybe it might increase manifold.
Yes.
So in that case, of course, the heirs are not supposed to pay khums, nor the recipient of the gift, okay, is supposed to give to pay khums on the increase,
right.
Maybe on the market value increase. So of course, if that let's say inherited amount or inherited property is kept for trading purposes and for the increase in their value, then the situation is different. Because if that in building, let's say, a property is kept for business, okay, let's do business with this,
mm-hmm.
let's increase the amount, okay, the amount increase, the value increase, of course, that is a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, of course, the heirs should, as a measure of obligatory precaution, because this is a measure, it's not a fatwa, it's just a precaution, the heirs should pay khums on the appreciation and of course and selling after it's sold to the people, after it's sold, you know.
So you mean if they consider this as an asset,
yes.
for doing business with it for a profit.
Profit,
then
yes.
The scenario changes.
The certain scenarios.
So it's changes. Not inheritance anymore, and then it's payable on khums.
Khums should be paid as yes. a measure of obligatory precaution.
Precaution.
Because when it's precaution, it's precaution. It's not a fatwa.
Yes.
And of course, in such matters, we understand that in matters of precaution, we can refer to another mujtahid who may have mm-hmm. a fatwa.
Yes. Well, Sheikh Chawid, another quick question that I may squeeze in fact, at the end of this episode. Someone says an insurance company owes me an amount in lieu of medical expenses, and I will receive it one of these days. Is it subject to khums?
Well, the amount paid for treatment and the like from one's income, and then, for example, it is returned by the insurance company,
mm-hmm.
are not ruled as new income. Rather,
right.
they return the very money of the person, you know, saved mm-hmm. up with the insurance company.
Yes.
So if it's not spent on living expenses until the end of the khums year, it will be liable to khums. But if it is returned after the end of the khums year, it is khums must be paid immediately, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it is your money, it's saved with the insurance company, and once it's returned, or sometimes it's returned before the khums year, sometimes it's returned after the khums year. Now, if it is returned after the khums year, it's necessary that you take action to pay its khums immediately.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much, Sheikh Chawid. Thank you, my dear listeners, for choosing our channel, our IRIB English Radio, for the program Islamic Laws. And we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly life of the most outstanding Shiite dignitaries all across the history of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, there are two special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sheikh Fadai. Sheikh Fadai, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the outstanding Shiite dignitaries, mainly known by the name of Kumayt ibn Zayd ibn Asadi, or Kumayt ibn Zayd Asadi Hilali Kufi. He was among the belletrists, the literary man, we can say the poets, the eulogists of the Ahlul Bayt. There are so many outstanding details about the life of these outstanding men of literature, we can call them men of letters. Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the early life and background of Kumayt ibn Zayd Asadi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Kumayt ibn Zayd Asadi lived in the second Islamic century, was among the great Arab poets who composed lots of poems in Arabic. In these poems, mostly he praised the Ahl al-Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam, and he belonged to the tribe called Mudar. Yes. And of course, he was among the companions of Imam al-Sajjad, Imam al-Baqir, and Imam al-Sadiq alayhim salatu wassalam. He lived in the time of Umayyads, but most of his poems, he praised the Ahl al-Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam, among which Qasa'id Hashimiyat, which are like poetries in which he praised the Banu Hashim, the Ahl al-Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam, are well known among the other poets of him.
That's right. Okay. Sheikh Fadai, was it a tradition on that time to, for example, recite some poems or create some poems regarding the Fazail of the Ahl al-Bayt and the Hashimites? Or no, it was something related, for example, to family relations or favoritism, nepotism, something related to, for example, blood relation or something like that.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, at that time, usually poem was used for non-religious goals, and usually, as you said, for family trees, I don't know, about the tribes, about... even about the wars, about the violence. They were proud of their violence and made poets about that. Mm-hmm. But we can say that Kumayt was one of the pioneers of poets who started to talk about reality, talk about truth, to praise Ahlul Bayt. And here maybe there is a question or problem about poem. Some believe that, even in Islamic studies, some believe that poem is something wrong. We shouldn't use that, especially because we have a verse about poem in Quran.
Yes.
Let me recite it for you. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والشعراء يتبعهم الغابون ألم ترى أنهم في كل واد يهيمون وأنهم يقولون ما لا يفعلون. You know, in this verse, God says that poets are some people who lead the wrong side of society, who lead battle.
Okay.
And because of this verse, some people believe, religious people believe that poem is something wrong. We shouldn't use it for our religious goals. But if we pay attention to the next part of the verse, where we recite, وَأَنَّهُمْ يَقُولُونَ مَا لَا يَفْعَلُونَ, the problem is that mostly, especially at that time, in the ignorance age, mostly they said something that they do not do. They just wanted to exaggerate about themselves. And إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ وَذَكَرُوا اللَّهَ كَثِيرًا. As you see, here there is an exception. Except people, الَّذِينَ مِنْ شُعَرَى. Except the poets who آمَنُوا. They are believers. وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ.
Yes.
They have wrong deeds.
Okay.
And ذَكَرُوا اللَّهَ كَثِيرًا. They remember God. You know, when you say and compose poem for Ahlul Bayt in the way of God, this is dhikrullah. So some poets like Kumayt, they were the example of dhikrullah kathiran. Like, for example, the complex of Hashimiyat we have.
We'll talk about this about that. Hashimiyat.
No, this is dhikrullah, because the dhikr of Ahlul Bayt, remembrance of Ahlul Bayt, is remembrance of God. So we cannot say that God is against poem. What kind of poem? That's not something that Kumayt were on that side.
Especially, we know that at that time, especially in the Jahiliyyah period, in the early Islam, there were so many poets who recited or composed poems regarding idols.
Yes.
You know, still, the text of those poems exists. Or at the time of Pharaoh, in Vikas' admiration of the Pharaoh, no name of God or divinity could be seen in the poems of such people.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
Sheikh Rouhani, Kumayt ibn Zayd al-Asadi is mainly known by Qasa'id Hashimiyat. What are they exactly? What is Qasida? And why is it called Qasa'id al-Hashimiyat?
Yeah, among the most important poetries composed by this poet is that Qasa'id Hashimiyat, which are poetries related to the Ahlul Bayt, to the children of the Holy Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. The main events which were relevant to the Ahlul Bayt, they were mentioned in these poems. Like, for example, virtues of Bani Hashim. Or, for example, the Ghadir event, which is the very significant event in the history of Islam.
Yes.
As well as the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam.
Okay.
And also the issue of Khilafa and Imama and Imamate of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. And also those oppression leveled against Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam by the Umayyads.
Yes.
Like, for example, martyrdom of Zayd ibn Ali. And the rest of issues related to Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wassalam, they are all included in these poetries. Actually, the sadness, the sympathy we see in these poetries with the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wassalam, and also resistance against the oppressors and encouraging the people to resist against the oppressors of the time. They are the main things that we see in these kind of poetries. Yes.
Okay. Sheikh Fadai, how much do people, I mean, researchers of the history of Islam and the Shiite Islam, can trust the authenticity of this poem as a historical text? I mean, the literary aspects, I mean, the artistic aspects are one side. From the other side, can we trust them as a historical resource or historical reference in order to be more familiar with the main events that took place during the history of Shiite Islam or not?
You know, poem itself cannot be trustable evidence for history if we consider that alone.
Yes.
You know, for history, we have history books. And for riwayah, we have the sciences of rijal, diraya, and yes. fiqh al-hadith. Poem can be some witness uh-huh. for those we have in the science of history and riwayah.
Yes.
You know, in Hawza and Islamic studies, we do not use poem as one of the main and column of evidence of history. No. We can use them, use the poems, as I told you, some witness.
Uh-huh.
When we research in history that something happened, for example, the events of Karbala.
Yes.
We do not get that from the poems. Uh-huh. We get that from the books of history.
Yes.
But when we see the poems of some poets like Khomeini,
yes.
We can acknowledge that event.
Yes.
But what is the role of poem in history?
Uh-huh.
You know, the something which is important is
yes.
that role.
Yes.
The role of poem is to teach people the lessons of history.
That's right.
For example, after the events of Karbala, we get the event from the history books, but what about the point, what happened, and which side is the battle side, which
yes.
side is the haq side?
Yes.
You know, poem is a kind of art,
uh-huh.
and the role of art is to introduce the
yes.
real ideology.
Yes.
Of course, sometimes they use art for the
yes.
wronger ideology.
That's right.
But some poets like Khomeini,
yes.
you know, they did their best in order to introduce and spread
yes.
the Islamic
mm-hmm.
ideology in the Islamic society.
Yes.
So they teach those teachings,
mm.
not to prove that.
That's right. And we know that the infallible Shiite imams were not that much free on that time to defend their rights. Sheikh Rouhani, is it so?
Yeah, of course.
So, for example, poets like Khomeini, who were contemporary to three or four imams, had the chance of listening to the historical documents and the facts from the tongue of the infallible imams and then changing them into pieces of poetry, like, for example, Qadir event, which
yeah,
is very much important, okay?
Yeah.
The imams were not that much able to talk freely about Qadir event. But through the language of poetry and composing poems, so many historical facts could be transferred to the next generations of the Shiites, isn't it so?
Yeah, of course. As you rightly mentioned, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam were under the control, under the observation of the serious observation of the kings and the Salatin and Umara. They did not have any chance to spread their teachings and doctrines or even to introduce themselves to the people in a way that they deserved. But these poets, like this great poet that we are now talking about,
Khomeini
ibn Zayd, he had many qasa'id. One of them is Qasida Mimiya, in which actually he praised the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, and of course mentioned in his poem many nice, let's say, couplets about Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam and the event of Karbala. When he read this poem for Imam al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, Imam al-Baqir cried a lot and made dua for Khomeini.
Yes.
And said that the way that the thing that the Holy Prophet, our forefather, our grandfather, said to Hassan ibn Thabit,
yes,
that whenever you defend our Ahlul Bayt, you would be, let's say, admired or admitted by the Ruh al-Qudus.
Yes.
So this was the saying of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam for this great poet. And also it is said that in many other qasa'id, like Qasida Lamiya again,
yes,
in which this great poet refers to the most important events related to the life of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam.
Very good.
And it is said that once he read this poem for Imam al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam and referred to the event of Ashura,
yes,
and the arrows that came from Yazid's army to Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam.
It was not many times, but 15 to 20 years after the story of
yeah,
Ashura,
of yeah,
he composed. So we can
yeah.
say regarding time, he was very much close to the event.
Yeah, of course. And then when it say that when he read this poem for Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, Imam al-Baqir raised his hands and said this dua that may Allah forgive Khomeini, may Allah forgive Khomeini. So this way that Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam also praised these poets and made lots of du'as for the poets of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. Among them is this Kumayti Asadi.
Okay, Sheikh Fadai, anything missed?
I want to say that when we see, as my brother mentioned, that Imam, like Imam Baqir, Imam Sa'd, prayed for Kumayt, what is the reason? The reason is to introduce and spread the doctrine of Islam by the tool of art. This is a lesson for us for today. Today, as we see the side of Batil, they are doing that. They try to spread their doctrine by art, for example, by Hollywood, by making a lot of animations and movies. So why are we so neglectful about that, about art? In the side of Haq, we do not use art as well. You know, at that time, there was not any cinema. We can say the most important or the only art were poems at that time.
Yes.
And Shiite poets used that art as instrument, as a tool, very well.
Yes.
You know, because of that, our Imam prayed for them a lot.
That's
and
right.
Even Imam prayed for his martyrdom.
Uh-huh.
So because of their role. And nowadays, we need that. We need to look at the art and use it as well as possible in order to spread
Haq
all around the world.
Okay, that's right. Well, we know that art and artistic forms, especially literature, are a good channel in order to convey the messages of Islam and the Shiite Islam to the next generation. And nowadays, they are used in a good way in order to transfer. These are historical facts, you know, that are the eulogies, the elegies, you know, the Marcia, you know, and all these poems in different formats are nice means and channels in order to transfer some historical facts and the oppressions that were done towards Ahlul Bayt. As you said, Kumayt was martyred. It was during the Khalafa of Marwan ibn Muhammad, the last Umayyad Caliph, in the year 126. He passed away in Kufa. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam did dua for his shahada, and he was the first one who is buried in the Bani Asad cemetery. May Allah bless the soul of this true defender of the Ahlul Bayt, Kumayt ibn Zayd Asadi. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding his life. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi aman.
In the limelight.
Euromed Human Rights Monitor has renewed its call on the international community, especially the signatory states to the Geneva Convention, to carry out their responsibilities to provide protection for civilians in the Gaza Strip. It further stressed that the need for a permanent ceasefire has become urgent and that, in order to stop the ongoing genocide war, an immediate international investigation must be launched into the Zionist regime's horrific crimes. Any countries that remain silent are actively encouraging Israeli regime genocide, the rights group said. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, the Israeli regime army has executed dozens of elderly people in Gaza in direct shooting operations since October 7th, a human rights group has said. In a statement issued recently, Euromed Human Rights Monitor said, 1,049 elderly men and women have been killed so far, About 1% of the estimated 107,000 elderly people who live in the Gaza Strip, and 3.9% of all Palestinian deaths during the aggression. The majority of them were crushed to death under the debris of their homes or the shelter centers where they sought safety after Israeli aircraft bombed their homes or while being forced to seek basic necessities in the streets and marketplaces. Alarmingly, however, dozens were targeted in killings and failed executions, the group said. The Geneva-based organization stated that it had received horrifying testimony regarding killings and failed executions of several people over the age of 60. The statement added, these incidents included troops shooting elderly people immediately after ordering them to evacuate their homes, and in some cases, executing them just moments after their release from hours or days of arbitrary detention. The group also stated the elderly are paying a high price for the disproportionate attacks carried out by Israeli forces, as hundreds of them have been killed in Israel's genocide and thousands more injured. According to the group, numerous elderly civilians, including both men and women over the age of 70 and even 80, have experienced detention. It added, testimonies from released detainees affirm that they were denied access to treatment and subjected to torture and abuse regardless of their difficult health situation and or advanced age. According to Euromed Monitor, Israel is waging a campaign of widespread punishment and killing and oppressing Palestinian society's most vulnerable groups in a way that is seldom seen in the modern history of wars or armed conflicts. The organization renewed its call on the international community, especially the signatory states to the Geneva Convention, to carry out their responsibilities to provide protection for civilians in the Gaza Strip. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, 20,424 Palestinians have been killed and 54,036 wounded in the Zionist regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza starting on October 7th. Palestinian and international estimates say that the majority of those killed and wounded are women and children. The website of Euromed Human Rights Monitor wrote, the Geneva-based organization stated that it had received horrifying testimony regarding killings and failed executions of several people over the age of 60. These incidents included troops shooting elderly people immediately after ordering them to evacuate their homes and in some cases executing them just moments after their release from hours or days of arbitrary detention. According to Euromed Monitor, the elderly Dr. Akram Abu Hasira and his wife were shot and left to bleed to death by the Zionist regime forces on Thursday, December 21st, after being forcibly evacuated from their home on Yarmouk Street in Gaza City. The Zionist regime's troops then set fire to their home. Their son, Dr. Mahmoud Abu Hasira, reported that after the Zionist regime forces withdrew from the area, their family managed to bury the couple's bodies. Furthermore, Ahmad Suleiman Hassan Muhammad Abdul Al, a 60-year-old mentally ill man, was shot and killed in his Jabalia camp home on December 13th, said Euromed Monitor, adding his killing occurred after Israeli regime troops stormed the camp and Abdul Al's home after a days-long siege on the Yemeni hospital. Abdel Nasser Khadar Habub, 62, was also killed, Euromed Monitor reported, when Israeli regime forces fired an artillery shell at him shortly after his release from a two-day detention. This incident also claimed the lives of Palestine University's College of Information Technology Dean, Dr. Ahmad Hamdi Abu Absa, 38. An eyewitness told